Welcome to the Recruitment Flex with Serge and Shelly. I'm Serge.
And I'm Shelly. And we talk all things recruitment starting right now.
Bonjour and welcome to the Recruitment Flex. Shelly, we've had this guy on the show way too much, but I figured we'd bring him on again because he is our favorite Dutchman.
Yes, our friend from overseas. I'm very pleased and excited to have back on the show to talk about his new book coming up. Joining us today is Bas van de Hatred, and he is co-author of a new book that's going to be released here in Canada February 27th called Talent Acquisition Excellence. And he's co-author with Kevin Wheeler. Bas, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. And it's actually launching the 21st in the US and the 27th in Canada. It's already out in Europe. For some reason, we're ahead of you guys for once in our life.
Awesome. Super excited. We've got lots of things we want to talk about. But for the audience who's not met you before, or maybe hadn't listened to the back catalog, start things off with giving us a little bit about your background, please, Bas.
Well, my name is Bas van de Hatred. I live in the center of the Netherlands, and I have been in the industry for about 20 years now. My main two areas of consulting are in corporate career sites and recruitment marketing, and actually in assessment and selection technology. I speak all over the world. Going to Canada or the US to speak is still on my bucket list, very high these days, because I've had pretty much every other continent except for Africa. And I do a lot of podcasts, and I run a massive research and event here in the Netherlands.
Cool. I think you missed one piece of trivia. This is book number 6 for you, or book number 5 that you've published?
It depends on how you count, because one of them was an ebook. So that's always up for debate. Was it actually a book? So then it's book number 6. It's the first one in English. The others are all in Dutch. One got translated and actually had one copy sold on Kindle. So now it doesn't really count.
So let's talk a little bit about, first of all, Kevin Wheeler is regarded as the OG of talent acquisition, certainly here in North America. So talk a little bit about your inspiration for writing the book and joining forces as a co-author with Kevin.
Well, to be honest, the reason was very simple. COVID hit. My agenda all of a sudden completely cleared up. I assumed Kevin's would as well. He's one of my biggest inspirations, one of the most influential guys in the industry. Mm-hmm. I've known him for years now. And I just reached out like, Kevin, I've got nothing to do. Would you do me the honor of co-authoring a book with me? And he immediately replied and said, I've been wanting to write a book forever, but never been able to get past chapter 1. So with you on my side, having published 5 books, I might actually finally finish a book. So yeah, let's do this. It actually took until we physically met when it was safe to travel again 2 years later, when we finally started writing it. But during COVID, we had weekly calls. We collaborated, which was just very nice and inspirational to do.
What is the biggest pain about writing a book? What is the biggest challenge?
The biggest pain of writing a book, first of all, it's writing the stuff that needs to be in there, but isn't really inspiring to write. So I wrote a definition of what I consider to be employer branding. What do you consider to be an employee value proposition? Mm-hmm. Because you need to define stuff in order for a book to make it readable. In an article, you can just say, you need an employer value proposition, and nobody will start debating that. In a book, there's a lot of things in there, and this is an American publisher, which means that they're afraid to get sued a lot more than the European publishers. So they need a reference for everything you say. So you
really
need to, everything you put in there needs a reference. If you say Facebook has this, they're like, can I get a reference of this? Which article are you referencing? And in Europe, it's usually about, can we give it some credibility? And the Americans are a lot like, can we make sure we won't get sued about this?
I want to deep dive into the book. There was a couple of things that really piqued my interest. Focus on credentials versus job performance. Sometimes we have the mentality that you need 20 years of university, 20 years of experience before you can be good at your jobs. So what are some of the myths surrounding formal education and actual job performance?
The biggest myth is that there is a correlation. I mean, I always use the example, and I know this is not a Canadian heavy sport, but of soccer, we call it football. Yeah. And I don't know if you've ever heard of a club called Inter Milan, one of the biggest teams in Italy, right? Now, there was a guy who was actually a goalkeeper at Inter Milan for 13 years. His resume says 13 years of being a goalkeeper at Inter Milan. And during that time, he played 2 games. So that's experience for you. His resume reads 13 years. He was sometimes allowed to be on the bench. And they actually, the second match, they only allowed him because he was retiring. What I always do, if you look at credentials, and I'm not even talking about formal education, we'll probably get to that later. But when it comes to how many years of experience do you need? So a hiring manager comes to me and says, we need at least 4 years of experience. And I always ask, what do you learn in the last month? And they're like, how do you mean? I said, apparently 3 years and 11 months isn't good enough. So what has this guy learned in that last month? Yeah, don't take me so literally. Okay, so what have you learned in the last 6 months? And we go back and eventually I'm like, so how do we describe the experience? What should somebody have done? And I can tell you, I got thrown in the deep end when I was just out of college. Literally, my very first job was running a business unit. I was completely unqualified, and I screwed that up pretty well. But I learned so much that I now do have the experience, especially how not to do it, which is also why I don't want staff. But that's a different story. I'm not saying experience doesn't matter. I'm saying we shouldn't measure it in years.
Let's talk about formal education. Obviously, here in North America, especially in the U.S., the school you went to, your GPA, what you took, is usually the first thing that's written in the job description. In Europe, is it very similar to North America where formal education is like the number one criteria that most recruiters look for?
Europe isn't one country, as you must remember. And
But
on this part, there's a very big difference between countries. So UK is much more America-oriented, like Oxford, Cambridge, Eton, very important. In Germany, and Shelley, you might know that because you have a son there, if I'm not mistaken, when you apply, you send your grades along, which is completely uncommon in the Netherlands, except for lawyers. For some reason, we always want your grade list and all the rest never look at it. By the way, the fact that in Germany, you always send your grades along, even way into your career, is probably the reason they have the lowest labor market discrimination in the world.
Lowest?
The lowest.
Talk a little bit about that, boss.
It's the hypothesis. Actually, Northwestern did amazing research on all the discrimination researchers in the world. America and Canada are actually very low on that list. You don't discriminate as much as, for example, us Dutch. The worst country in the world is the French. The second worst in the world is the Swedish. It's probably because the Swedish, if you hire somebody, you pretty much can't fire that person ever again. So you go with what you know, which is the white guy called Serge Boudreau, for example. Although that's even a French name, so they might be already hesitant about that because nobody likes the French in Europe. No, that's not true. We like them to have party with and their excellent taste in wine, not their work ethic.
Well, so in your opinion, what is the importance of formal education going into a world of skill-based hiring?
It depends on the education. I really like my pilot to have his pilot license.
Yes.
Really like my nurse to have her nursing license or his nursing license to know which vein to put it in. I don't give a rat's ass what my recruiter studied. I think IT is actually one of the things where we look the least for formal education because so many people are self-taught.
Yeah.
And we replace them with coding tests, which are now, because of ChatGPT, not that accurate anymore. But they were the first to say, listen, somebody with a formal education in IT, we still have no clue if this guy or girl can program or develop anything. Mm-hmm. So let's test it. You're seeing the shift right now, but we're still, I think, too hung up on formal education. And I'm not saying formal education doesn't matter. I'm just saying we should look at what did the guy or girl actually learn during that education.
What's your advice to practitioners or talent acquisition leaders that are dealing with hiring managers that are demanding a certain set of qualification? Let's use a recruiter role, right? Here in Canada, they're CPHR, which is a designation. What advice would you give for them to push back on these hiring managers?
The first question I always ask them is, give me your best recruiter or your best two or three recruiters. Let's see what those people did. And I can tell you, pretty sure one of them, usually all of them, do not have the formal education you're requiring. Yeah. I had this discussion once with a headhunter in IT, and he told me, listen, I have four hiring managers. And all of them said a formal IT education is mandatory because else they don't understand the big picture, blah, blah, blah. And he's, who's your top performer? And everybody mentioned one guy in every team. And those top performers, neither of them had a formal education in IT, and all the rest of the team had. So he's saying, okay, so you're telling me that you would be willing to let your top performer, your 10X guy, the guy you think is 10 times as good as all the others, you don't want me to look for a second one. Okay. Now, if you're thinking more structural, and that's actually what we try to do in the book, and I hope you read that, we've got, you know, the structure and then the tactics, the operations. Also because Kevin is much more the structure. I'm more of the tactical side, which is why I loved our collaboration so much. He looks at it from a global TA leader perspective. And then I'm like, okay, and how would the Dutch or the Canadian TA leader implement this on the ground? And so what I recently did at one of my clients was we had to buy a new ATS anyway. And I said, okay, with every new rec entering, I want the five competencies for this job. And everybody was like, yeah, but they're just going to fill something in. I'm like, that's amazing. Because we've got them thinking about skills and we're building a database of the skills we eventually have to go measure. But at least we've got the conversation going and we're not going to measure anything yet. Because this organization, I literally hired their first person dedicated to recruitment. You know, this was HR recruitment and everything has always gone the same way and blah, blah, blah. This was like level zero for the model, which is in the book. We're buying an ATS, basically for the, they had an ATS, which I wouldn't call an ATS. So it was Excel on steroids, basically. And now we're buying an actual ATS. And I said, we're going to put in skills. And then somebody said, we actually bought this interview manual once. Should we look at if we can give them skill-based questions in the interview setting to the hiring managers? And everybody's like, oh, they're not going to accept that. And all the hiring managers are like, wow, amazing. Now I know how I have to ask.
Now I know what to ask, yeah.
And it turned out they wanted advice. And everybody in HR was always afraid to give them advice because they were that arrogant and, you know, hiring managers will never accept. And they loved it.
Mm-hmm. So, boss, I'm glad you started the conversation here around that because the recruitment process itself, when I read through the book, I was like, yes, okay. So there is some universal view in the recruitment process. Can you maybe just give the audience an idea of what are some of the global similarities? Because you just touched on it. I know that's exactly the same process we follow here in Canada and the US. But I think for a lot of our audience, we tend to think they must do it differently in the Netherlands or they must do it differently in Japan. What would you point to as that global standard in recruitment process?
Well, the basic process is the same all over the world. It's just certain dynamics which are different, certain laws which are different. You start with an intake, you either advertise or source, you do a pre-screen, you do the interviews. I know that phone screens are much more common in the US and Canada than they are in Europe. The Netherlands, because we're a small country, we do a lot more on-site interviews because literally from my house, there's no place I can't be in 2 hours by car. It depends on how your laws are. So, for example, I know you guys have a lot of background checking and things like that because you can get sued as an employer in the Netherlands. And this is one of the very few things I think we've done right when it comes to employment law. We have what we call a declaration of no objection, which the employer sends to the Ministry of Justice. This is the things this guy is going to do. So in my case, it was like he's going to consult for HR jobs. They will link my tasks to potential misdemeanors or conviction.
Oh, wow.
And they will tell them, it's okay, you can hire this guy. If I was to work with kids and I had a drunk driving, no problem. If I am to drive a taxi and I had a drunk driving, red flag. If I was to work with kids and I had a sexual offense, red flag. And it cost you 15 quid to do the background check, except for some really high up jobs. That's most of the background screening we do. And it depends a lot on how your labor market is.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of work in the Middle East until last year. They hate advertising because they get at least 10,000 resumes, of which 9,900 are completely unqualified. I've been working a lot more with free screening tools. Here in the Netherlands, we've noticed, for example, that if you advertise your jobs in English, you get a lot more resumes as well from India, Pakistan, and all those areas in the world where we're not allowed to hire. The dynamics around the job are different. The process is very close to universal.
Yeah.
So one more thing I wanted to ask kind of a global perspective on, and that is for someone who is head of TA or head of the function, and when they're faced with a decision of building your in-house team versus RPO or outsourced, when you look around the world, are there different things to be aware of or consider if you're going to bring in-house or outsource?
I think there are different things that are considered. I'm not sure if they should be. So I know that Kevin talks a lot about RPO because in the US, RPO is a really big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the Netherlands, we see almost no genuine RPO and we see a lot of embedded talent solutions. So I know there's one company which says they RPO'd everything out, but then the company still has their internal decision on their corporate careers website. I'm like, that's no RPO because you're forcing them to use incompetent tech. You chose the ATS, not the RPO, so that's not RPO. And actually, this was one of the big debates between Kevin and me because Kevin loves his RPO and I am always questioning it a lot. Maybe because I haven't seen really great examples. Because most of what I see is in the Netherlands is half-baked. Either have it raw or not at all. But anyway, we came to the conclusion, and this was one of the many debates Kevin and I had. At some point, we knew we were both right, yet we were on the completely opposite side of the coin when it came to RPOs. And we came to the point where we said, if your C-suite treats you like a cost center, act like one and go RPO. If your C-suite put their money where their mouth is and says, talent is our biggest asset, so at the Facebooks, at the Googles, at the Amazons, or at Emirates Airways, to give you an example, here's enough budget to do something really serious, keep it in-house. Because if you've got the budget, in-house always works better than.
Thank you. I believe that too.
So one of the things that I'm quite passionate about is programmatic advertising. And in Canada, programmatic has not taken any leaps. Europe has been, and I know Europe is a bunch of different countries, so I get that. But overall, as a continent, they have not adopted programmatic advertising the same way as the US has. Are we going to catch up with the US in leveraging programmatic advertising? Because I just read an article the other day that 82% of marketing is bought through programmatic advertising. Why are we not doing that in our acquisition?
I actually don't know if we are that far behind the US, to be honest. I think it's more a definition piece. I've always heard people talk about they don't do programmatic. And I'm like, our job boards, most of them don't. But then again, Indeed does, and Indeed is most of the job board market in many countries. And most of our ad money goes into campaigning these days, not the job boards. And campaigning you do on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Google, yeah, which is all programmatic. The thing is, most advertising agencies don't call it programmatic because the buyers don't know what programmatic is unless they listen to Chat and Cheese. They just say we do it pay-per-click. I think it's more of a definition thing than that we actually don't do programmatic. Now, I will admit US and the job boards, ZipRecruiter, things like that, those are ahead of us. In the Netherlands, Monster Board is still big. Yeah, they're still alive. They're still kicking. They're still pretty decent. You have to remember that we all have employment agencies, yeah, in every country, which as soon as you have a job, it's mandatory to put your job open on their website and free.
Yeah.
And in many countries, that's the biggest job board. So why don't we do programmatic? Because we've got free advertising paid for by the National Labor Association.
Fair enough. Okay. That's a good point. In your book, you start talking quite a bit about AI, and I know AI has been the biggest topic of conversation in talent acquisition, I would say, over the last year and a half. Just curious, what's your overall perspective on AI in the talent acquisition space? Is it going to be good or bad?
Oh, that's is a car good or bad? It gets you from A to B, but it's now destroying the environment. I don't know about good or bad, and it has a lot of things about how we're going to use it. It has an amazing potential upside. To go back to the recruitment marketing piece, what we described in the book as well is what we call next generation programmatic, where we're not just bidding, but we're also adjusting ads to people who've seen it to see how far along the journey from a candidate to becoming an applicant is search already. There's a great case study in there from a guy here in the Netherlands who was doing traineeships. And they had this very unknown brand looking for technicians, which is like insanely scarce. And then he was able to fill each and every one of his traineeships 6 months before those people graduated, and they, all of a sudden, videos started popping up in their Facebook feed and Insta feed about doing a traineeship and learning more types. And some clicked, some didn't, but he was able to see how long did they watch the video. And then he literally said, so many people said to me, yeah, it's so weird. I actually saw your ads like 6 months ago, and now all of a sudden this job ad pops up in my feed. I had to reply. And he's like, yeah, that's not weird. That's called remarketing. But now technology can do that on steroids. Actually, technology might be able to give search a little bit of a different ad than Shelly.
Yeah.
For example, a male versus a female photo. So we've seen so many, and there are a few case studies in the book on great advertising, on persona-based. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm thinking will be there in 2025, dynamically adjusting job ads. Every job has at least 20 or 30 things which might excite you. But there are only 5 of them which will excite search, and maybe Shelley will have one of them in common, but she finds 4 other ones interesting. Let's serve out not what I as a recruiter think is the most interesting part of the job, but based on your behavior, what you think, what the AI thinks is for you as a person, the most interesting part of the job. Is that the salary? Is that the flexible time? Mm-hmm. Is that the team? Is that the remote working options? I don't know. It just isn't for everybody.
So, Boz, really good perspective. It's one of the elements that I think we can all agree recruitment marketing is going to get better with AI. Where I guess I have more concern is when it comes to candidate selection side of the equation, right? And how companies are going to leverage AI potentially to tip the scale with one candidate over the other. As a very intellectual guy, what's your concerns about leveraging AI to potentially shortlist, candidate match, or even in some cases, select the person they're going to hire?
As an intellectual, I will give you an intellectual answer. It depends. I'm for it. I've been talking to too many scientists on exactly this topic. If you compare it to the current state of human, basically, it can't get any worse.
Fair.
John Sullivan's research, 50% of all the people we hire should be considered a mishire. There isn't a single profession in the world where you can fill half of the time and still have a job, except for recruiters. If your legal team made contracts which were only legal half of the time, I'm pretty sure you had a problem as a lawyer. If your salary was only correct 50% of the time, your salary administrator would be kicked out, right? And for recruiters, we're like, yeah, can't be helped. So the bar is extremely low. From that perspective, I'm saying the only way is up, because we pretty much can't screw it up anymore than we're already doing.
But we asked that question to Hilke, who wrote the book, The Algorithm. And one of the things that she said is, okay, if I have a bias, it may be affecting 10 people that gone through the bias. But if the algorithm has a bias, we could potentially affecting millions of people. It just scales way bigger, which I think is part of the concern.
And that's actually my second part on the it depends. Yes, because she's right, it scales. Now, unfortunately, human bias scales as well, because we're also still discriminating a lot in every part of the equation. But the great thing about algorithms is we can basically torture them to give up their biases. We can simply beat the algorithm, check it. And the one thing I've been trying with hiring managers is literally telling me, so why are you rejecting Mohammed or Kareem and not Serge? They'll always find something in the CV why that wasn't the perfect match, right? The algorithm, we can fix that. Amazon, the famous case, actually audited their algorithm and, hey, no women came through. Oh, maybe we need to delete this algorithm, which they did. Oops, didn't work. Yes, I agree that it's a big risk. That's why we need algorithm auditors. That's why we need to be very careful of what we're doing. Very careful. The great thing is the EU is having an AI Act soon, which has actually said hiring and everything which has to do with HR is highest risk. And you need to take every measure possible. And it actually says, and I'm really curious to see how they are going to enforce it, but it actually says you're only allowed to use scientifically validated measures to select. So basically, that's also saying you can't select on a CV anymore, because there's no scientific research ever showing that a CV works. I'm not sure if they completely thought that part through, but within the algorithms, it's going to be a lot better checked.
I agree. I think it's going to be a really interesting time for the next little while. So, boss, there is a lot of info out there for recruiters and talent acquisition leaders. Why should your book be the book that they read?
First of all, because I wrote it with Kevin Wheeler.
That gives it some credibility. I'll agree with that.
That gives it a lot more credibility, because it's probably the only transatlantic cooperation in a book. Because it's got US and Europe in there, you can learn from each other. And what I personally liked the most about the book is the fact that we have high-level strategic thinking models combined with tactical on the ground. How should you be doing this? And what I personally think makes it unique is the scenarios. I wrote recruitment fiction on fictive companies. How did they do it? What did they do and not do? And I love writing those.
They were good. I love the example, and I think it's one of the things that I enjoyed most about the book. The other thing, too, is for any recruiter, sometimes having resources right next to you and the ability mm-hmm. to go back and take the book, take the notes. This is one, in my opinion, and I think, Shelley, you share this, it's one of those books that you should have next to you and be able to leverage on a daily basis as a practitioner. So, Boz, if anyone wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Without a doubt, LinkedIn.
Okay.
And my new website, vandehatert.nl, just launched today by accident, by the way. That wasn't planned for this podcast.
Perfect timing.
Boz, thank you so much for coming on again. It's always good to see you, our favorite Dutchman on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Boz. Au revoir.
Shelley, let's face it, texting candidates is the easiest way to hire quicker today. But your cell phone doesn't connect to your ATS. You're sharing your personal number with strangers. That's pretty scary, right, Shelley? And it's not even legally compliant.
This is where our friends at RecText come in. They've created simple yet powerful text recruiting software that works with your ATS. Plus, it's designed by recruiters for recruiters, so you know it works. To learn more and book a demo, visit www.rectxt.com, mention the Recruitment Flex, and get 10% off annual plans.
How much do you understand the future of finance? I'm Jim Roos, a top 10 banking influencer and host of the podcast Banking Transformed, where we dive deeply into the rapidly evolving world of banking and financial technology. Join me as I interview industry experts, thought leaders, and innovators as they unravel the latest banking trends, disruptions, and game-changing technologies reshaping the world of finance. Redefine your understanding of the banking ecosystem. Subscribe now to Banking Transformed, available wherever you get your podcasts, and now available on YouTube.